Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to this premium podcast of the Lotus Eaters, dedicated today to answering the question, is Jesus Christ a socialist? I am joined by Carl.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining me, because this is something that we theorized we would end up doing, I think, in the first podcast on my first day.
Really?
That I started here. You came up with the idea and I was very, very keen on it.
Okay.
So a lot of weight on my shoulders for this one, but it seems that people really enjoyed the content we did on Simone de Beauvoir and ancient Roman relationship advice. So I thought you were the perfect man for the job to challenge me on this sort of stuff. Also, I thought you were perfect for it because, as I said to you off air quite a while ago, I think it was 2016, you did an interview with Stephen Crowder back in the Sargon days, and you made the contentious claim at the time that you thought Jesus was a radical communist.
No. Not killing the baby up until conception and, no freedom and lack of empathy.
That's my point, isn't it? That's two issues. That's not like...
No, everything about it, though, it's, being a total... That's one thing, too. This idea that, here we get into the theology, Jesus was a liberal. There's nothing about him that was. I mean...
He wasn't a liberal.
Communist. No, he wasn't.
He was.
Give me the justification on that one.
I think I'm going to stand by that for the duration of this conversation.
That's just interesting. Okay, all right. Yeah, devil's advocacy, of course. I think we'll find a lot of concordance between...
Before we go on, though, I've learned a lot more than I knew then about socialism in particular. So there will be a way of attacking that claim that will be quite strong, but I think I can dodge around it.
You're right. Well, the main crux of your claim there... Mm. In the interview seem to be around the contention of the renunciation of all possessions.
Hmm.
And that is often the line you hear from communists trying to co-opt the Christian tradition into it. And I don't think that's genuine on their part.
Obviously.
Yeah, well, sure, I'm not going to lend much charitability to communists, but okay, the ones that are best versed in it, let's say.
Yeah.
But there's lots of people online, and I think not just the run-of-the-mill socialists, who we can conflate with Marxism here because it's not like they're sympathetic to fascism or Nazism, which are two cheeks, same backside. But also there are the value-neutral liberals and libertarians who also trot out the, well, Jesus was compassionate to X group, so you as a judgmental Christian shouldn't judge and should also agree with my materialistic presuppositions or my hedonistic lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's the Tom Harwood types I'm thinking of. You definitely get that as well. So the main claims that they always start off of are Jesus cared about the poor.
Sure.
I don't think socialists very much do.
No. They hate the rich.
Yeah.
And they use the poor as a weapon against the rich in order to reduce everyone to the same benighted position.
Yeah, Marx actually said that we're going to have to reduce people down to the lowest common denominator in order to enforce equity.
It's totally true.
And it plays out every time.
Logically inevitable.
Yeah, I have a video in the works that our wonderful editor Thomas is producing right now that tries to argue the point that because Marxism is an unworkable economic promise founded on faulty presuppositions. Yes, the appeal to it is the utopian dream, but it seems the intention that's played out, because the dream is so nebulous, is not the communist utopia, but actually the murderous socialist revenge. It seems to be the goal in and of itself. The process is the goal. And Orwell actually hit on this in Road to Wigan Pier, when he decided to characterize the character of the socialist, not as that of the compassionate poor, but as the sort of vengeful midwit.
And
he said, it may be said, however, that even if the theoretical book-trained socialist is not a working man himself, at least he is actuated by a love of the working class. He is endeavouring to shed his bourgeois status and fight on the side of the proletariat. That obviously must be his motive. But is it? Sometimes I look at a socialist, the intellectual tract-writing type of socialist, with his pullover, his fuzzy hair, and his Marxian quotation, some things never change, and wonder what the devil's motive really is. It is often difficult to believe that it is a love of anybody, especially of the working class, for whom he is of all people the furthest removed. The underlying motive of many socialists, I believe, is a simply hypertrophied sense of order. The present state of affairs offends them, not because it causes misery, still less because it makes freedom impossible, but because it is untidy. What they desire basically is to reduce the world to something resembling a chessboard. Poverty, and what is more, the habits of mind created by poverty, are something to be abolished from above, by violence if necessary, perhaps even preferably by violence. Hence his worship of the great men and appetite for dictatorships, fascist or communist. The truth is that to many people calling themselves socialists, revolution does not mean a movement of the masses with which they hope to associate themselves. It means a set of reforms which we, the clever ones, are going to impose upon them, the lower orders.
I mean, that's definitely one aspect of it. But I think that that's a narrow band of socialism and socialists. I think that there's a much larger band of those wealthy sons of very wealthy men who are just bitter at their fathers, actually, and use this as a revenge against their fathers.
That does sound about right when you see Carlos Marza.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking of. He's the example of that. But I think that's, look at Marx himself, this is, a lot of it is kind of, there's a kind of anger at the promise that has been unfulfilled by the people above. And so it's about essentially taking revenge for putting these fantasies in their head.
So it is a kind of rebellion against a father who did not give you all you felt you were entitled to.
Yes, and that expanded out to society writ large. Because, of course, the promises of liberalism are massive. And if anywhere they are unfulfilled, I mean, Marx himself is completely clear about this in the Communist Manifesto. It's like, no, you've gone halfway. We're going the whole way. And there's a kind of vengeance in it because of the unfulfilled nature of the promise, which is why it's so dangerous and which is why liberalism has been struggling with it for 150 years.
I agree with that assessment entirely. And so I'm going to hang my hat on that for later because we're going to come back to that. And I just wanted to do another royal quote as well, backing your point that it's more so resentment than it is an affirmative vision. This is from Lion and the Unicorn. It's a strange fact, but it is unquestionably true that almost any English intellectual would feel more ashamed of standing to attention during God Save the King than stealing from a poor box.
Famous that quote, and it's completely true.
And I actually admired these people. I thought, well, that's not very good. I admire them, and I don't share their political views. And then there's these other people with whom I hypothetically share political views, and I don't admire them at all. What's going on? And then I read Road to Wigan Pier, and I thought, oh, that's it. They don't like the poor. They just hate the rich. It's not the same thing. It's not the same set of motivations. And so let's say that you're a postmodernist, and you privilege compassion for the oppressed. Think, well, what do you push to the margins? Well, what are you doing with all your hatred and your resentment? And you're evil. It's like, you don't have any of that? That's a bad theory. That's a really bad theory. Okay, so fine. So you can say, well, yeah, you can say that. But I don't buy it. I still think that the people who stand to speak for the oppressed are in fact motivated by empathy and sympathy. Their hearts are in the right place. See, I don't really buy that either, because I don't really think, generally speaking, that it's a credible claim for someone to make that their heart is in the right place. Now, you can ask that of yourself, and if you think your heart is in the right place, well, more power to you. You know, I can't see the halo from here, however.
Yes. There's also the argument that Jesus was a refugee that you hear beaten over and over. And it's like, yes, he was. He was fleeing persecution at King Herod. That does not mean you let a bunch of economic boat migrants in the country.
Yeah, I mean, he was an actual refugee.
Yeah. So just trying to disarm you.
We're not complaining that they're taking Ukrainian women in. No one's complaining about that.
Well, yeah, because they're Ukrainian women.
Apart from maybe some people's wives.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not the complaint. You know, the complaint is that the people coming from France are not fleeing danger.
Yeah, they're disingenuous marauders.
Yes.
So I think all of these sort of disingenuous arguments elucidate the fact that even though they don't hold to charges of hypocrisy like the Christians do, they want to catch Christians by their own standards.
Yes.
Because Christ specifically said that hypocrisy was among the greatest of the sins. And they always try and get you with the Matthew and Luke verses, which go, do not judge so that you in turn may not be judged. And they don't continue with the rest of it, which is trying to set a standard of that which you live by, you may judge other people because you're meant to live by biblical scripture. Mm. But if you are a hypocrite, you cannot pass judgment because you would look ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But they always cut off at the do not be judged part. And I think that's just a deliberate way of trying to morally disarm you against the values that they're advancing. And then there's also Matthew 23, which says, therefore, be careful to do whatever they tell you, but do not follow their example, for they do not practice what they preach. And then Matthew 6, which is the one that always gets me about the virtue signalers. Mm. And I understand this charge is leveled at types who... So Jack Posobiec's a great example, who says, wake up, pray up. And they say, well, you're making a show of your Christianity.
Yeah.
But I'm fine to say that's wholesome. And it's a little bit American, so I'll let the bravado go
for the
It's
a bit cringe American, but it's not...
It's not putting a Ukraine flag in your bio.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but they're always going to level the thing at him saying... When you pray, go to your room, close the door, and pray to your father in secret, and your father who sees everything that is done in secret will reward you. Okay, don't pray on street corners. Don't make a display of your faith.
And Jack Posobiec can probably just say, yeah, I do that. Now what?
Yeah. Yeah. I do both, because they make a display of their faith. Yeah. It's the idea that it's about reciprocity and not hierarchy of values is again, the value-neutral liberal presupposition that doesn't ever work.
One of the things about Jack Posobiec is that the reason it's different from putting a Ukraine flag in your bio is because at least with Jack, you realize this is an authentic, truly held belief that he has. He was a Catholic before. He had Twitter. He'll be a Catholic afterwards, probably. And this is just a part of his life. It's not, the current thing demands that I put the Ukraine flag in my bio. You know, it's not a virtue signal in the same way.
Yeah. And it's also holding tight to your values and not, how do I phrase this? They are trying to enforce a law of neutrality upon you where is convenient for their ends. Whereas if you hold true to that principle of neutrality, you'll get rolled over like it's the tank tracks in Tiananmen Square.
They don't hold it.
No.
And moreover, I don't even see it as being, he's not praying. He's essentially putting out a sort of like a rallying call to his fellow Catholics saying, hey guys, I'm here. Let's all be Catholics over here so we can talk about XY subjects. He's not, you know, saying our Father who art in heaven.
Yeah, it's adequately gatekeeping.
Yeah.
Yeah. It just kind of reminds me of the there's a story in Matthew where Jesus going out to the fields and gleaning grain off the ground on the Sabbath and doing healing miracles. And the Pharisees come along and say, well, is this not the exact bit of scripture where you're told that on the Sabbath you have to kick your feet up and do absolutely nothing? And he says to them, okay, number one, if you believe in this text, then you're meant to be believing that I'm the Messiah so I can kind of do what I like because I'm doing the will of the Lord and I supersede that scripture. But also, really, you're going to come preaching verse and chapter to me when you don't live out these values yourselves? I'm just going to disregard you as a moral legislator. Hmm. And that's the point that I think Christians have to hold to is that these people don't believe in your values. They're just doing the Frank Herbert thing of they're appealing to your values when they're weak, and when they're strong, they will use their values to crush you.
Yeah. I wouldn't take them as moral authorities.
No. But I do think we have to contend with some of the verses that they're going to be using to say that Christianity actually lends credence to communism. Because there is an alarming article in the American magazine titled The Catholic Case for Communism. As you can imagine, I hate it.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine.
I'm not delighted. This is part of the Jesuit tradition, and the Jesuits are... I hesitate to accuse them of being the Masonic Lodge of the Catholic Church, but they are an old splinter order that operates within the church, and they have the mission for the global abolition of poverty. So you could see how they could be infiltrated by the Workers of the World Unite types.
Well, one of the things that I think that a lot of the left will say here is like, look, there are statements by Jesus like, it's easier for a rich man to go through the eye of a needle than to get into the kingdom of heaven, and things like this, that shows that there's a belief in Christian doctrine that wealth is a corrupting force and you'd be better not to have it.
Mm. Yes.
And what better way to become totally impoverished than become a communist?
Yes. However, and this comes back to the distinction. this comes back to the distinction, which I'll go into in a little bit more detail later, but this argument comes from people who don't really understand the aims of the communists. So it's not just the revolutionary terror, as we said, that is the goal that's played out over time. But if you truly believe in communism, you believe in dialectical materialism, which means that there is no spiritual dimension.
Sure.
Which means that you believe that Communism is the final end goal for the equitable redistribution and maximum production of wealth. Hmm. So you are actually aiming at material wealth. You're aiming at abundance. It's, you're not aiming at the confiscation, demolition of property.
I was taking communism as it is, not as it wishes it was.
Yes. It's got so the same it's got the same aims point. as autonomy maximizing liberalism.
No, that's actually a good point. And you can find this in almost any not even Marxist, just any communist tract where they will say what they expect to happen at the end is that everyone will have a high standard of living. And that's actually Jesus was not offering that actually.
No.
Go and be a pauper in the desert, actually. You know, then you'll get close to God. It's like, okay.
Yeah, he literally said, those who are persecuted and have all they are taken, and the Apostle Paul repeats this in, I think it's the first letter to the Corinthians, even if you're given rags to live in and starved, you will be vindicated in the fact that you are morally full, even though your belly is empty. And so what matters more is your integrity, not the amount of possessions that surround you.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah.
Fair point.
So in the Catholic case for communism, I just wanted to pull out one quote they specifically say, because I wanted to, I'm just going to say embarrass how shallow this writer really is. And they actually had to write a follow-up to the readers saying, why we publish this piece, please don't unsubscribe.
Yeah.
The writer says, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, Marx summarizes in Critique of the Gopher Program, a near echo of Luke's description of the early church in Acts 4.35 and 11.29. Perhaps it was Doris Day, not her young communist neighbor, who misunderstood communism. Now, I'm going to mention later the fact that that maxim right there, are you familiar where Marx formulated it from?
No.
So it's a deliberate inversion of Matthew 25:28.
Well, what's Matthew 25:28?
It is the parable of the talents. I'm just going to find it here.
Is it before you read it?
Yes.
Is it an injunction and a way of encouraging people to perform charity?
No.
Oh, okay.
It says that inequality will always exist.
Oh, the poor will always be with us.
No, therefore, take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents, for to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he does have will be taken away. And for this worthless servant, cast him out into the darkness where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Well, that does sound a lot like communism.
It's the Pareto principle.
Yes.
It's the Matthew principle. It is that, okay, resources will accrue to those who actually have talent over time, and the person who has nothing will become bitter and resentful and cast him out into darkness because he hasn't put his worth in. And so Marxism is literally reliant on the inversion of Christianity for its central principle.
Hmm.
But this guy doesn't understand that, but okay. But we'll take it on faith, as we do many things, and go into the Acts verses that he decides to cite, because the Acts verses are the first book straight after the Gospels, which says that this is what the apostles did after Christ was risen up from the dead and went up to heaven and sort of left them to their own devices. And they're interpreted as being an early sort of commune, because they do hold some property in common, even though they don't have a dictatorship of the proletariat, which was what Marx endorsed. So plays out slightly differently. So there's Acts 2, and it says, all the believers were together and owned everything in common. They would sell their property and possessions and distribute the proceeds to all according to what each one needed. Okay.
Wow, this is sounding quite socialist.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds quite communist. That's the thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's no actual violent confiscation.
Sure.
So it's self-associative. I wouldn't agree with it in scaling upwards, but the communists do. And then Acts 4, the entire community of believers was united in heart and soul. No one claimed any of his possessions as his own, for everything was held in common. With great power, the apostles bore witness to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and they were all greatly respected. There was never anyone among them in need, because those who were the owners of lands or houses would sell them, bring the proceeds of the sale, and lay them at the feet of the apostles, to be distributed to anyone who were in need. One such instance involved Joseph, a Levite and a native of Cyprus, to whom the apostles gave the name Barnabas, meaning son of encouragement. He sold a field that belonged to him, and then he brought the money to the apostles and laid it at their feet. So in practice, it's what a small hippie commune that would be operating off of the sort of low resolution perception of local Marxism rather than international Marxism and how it would play out.
Well, you could probably argue that this would be a different form of socialism. Some kind of like Kropotkin-style anarchist socialism.
Yes.
Where it's all voluntary interactions. There's no state involvement here. And it is just collective ownership of all wealth.
Yeah, and it would be a sort of meta-utopia in the framework that Robert Nozick set forth in the libertarian society, because you can have libertarian communities and communes existing cooperatively next to each other within a self-associative framework, but you can't have libertarian communities within a socialist and communist framework.
Yeah, this isn't like Marxism.
No, not at all. He still cited it. The number one story that's often said as being explicitly Marxist is in Acts 5. So there was a man named Ananias, and who with his wife Sapphira sold a piece of property. With the approval of his wife, he held back some of the proceeds, and he brought the remainder to the apostles and laid it at their feet. Peter asked, Ananias, why has Satan so gained control of your heart that you lied to the Holy Spirit and retained part of the sale price of the land? While it remained unsold, did it not belong to you? And after it was sold, were not the proceeds yours? What caused you to contrive this scheme? You have not lied not to men, but to God. When Ananias heard these words, he collapsed and died, and a great sense of fear seized all who heard about it. The young men came forth and wrapped up his body, and they carried him out and buried him. After about 3 hours, his wife came in, unaware of what had happened. Peter said to her, tell me whether you sold the land for this much. She replied, yes, that was the price. Then Peter asked her, why did the two of you agree to put the spirit of the Lord to the test? Listen, the footsteps of those who have buried your husband are at the door, and they will also carry you out. Instantly she fell down at his feet and died. When the young men came in, they found her dead, and so they carried her out and buried her beside her husband. Now, that seems an indictment of someone who did not collectivize property. But.
Right.
They were killed for the lying.
Sure.
Yes.
Also seems they didn't have to give up their property.
Yes.
That doesn't seem very nice.
What do you mean?
Well, you only gave us part of your property. You lied and told us you gave us all of it. And God's going to kill you.
It's more so that you... And this comes back to the don't pray on street corners thing. Don't make a show of your virtue when you are actively lying about how much you have done.
Sure.
So if you agree to be within the community and share the property, which I personally wouldn't, thanks. Yeah. Don't try and say that you're doing as much or more so than everyone else when you're holding back part for yourself because you're just being disingenuous.
And that's fair, but for God to then kill them both?
I think it's a bit harsh.
It's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Lord,
words in mysterious ways.
I yeah, dare I question, otherwise I'm going to end up face down on the podcast.
Yeah,
but there you go. Also, there is a thin argument for the armament and self-defense of the marginalized, because, of course, Christians were persecuted by the Romans. And so in Matthew 10, Christ does say, and this is the rejoinder to people that think Christianity is very passive. Do not think that I've come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. And then to Luke, he said, but now the one who has a money bag should take it with him as well as a sack. And if you do not have a sword, sell your cloak and purchase one.
But are these pretty much the only thing in Jesus's ministry that we can take as being tangentially involved in the endorsement of violence?
Not violence, but self-defense.
Sure. But any kind of violence.
There is also the verse in the Beatitudes, which is often misinterpreted, that we spoke about in our Genealogy of Morals book club, which is, it's translated incorrectly as blessed are the meek, which people take to mean as weak. But instead, the original translation is something more akin to blessed are those with the constitution of a bridled battle horse who holds back before charging in. So those kinds of metaphors are used to say you should be capable of violence and hold restraint. Mm-hmm. And then in Revelation, which I will probably finish on later, possibly the strongest kind of condemnation of sin and violent consequences are said by Jesus himself, or at least forecast to be said, according to the vision and Revelation. Hmm.
The question that will be raised then is, okay, well, what about turning the other cheek?
Yes. So there's a problem with reconciling that.
Yeah.
Because I think it's meant to be that if someone does that to you in public, you make an example and kill them with kindness. So I think it's meant to be that you're meant to mediate where the situation is appropriate to either. This is the example that I would use if I was on air. If you can discern that someone is shouting at you to get a Twitter clip and they're being disingenuous and they're not engaging in the argument, you just let them look ridiculous. It's the recent Jacob Rees-Mogg interview with that Just Stop Oil woman is a perfect example of that. He stays calm, he stays composed, and he doesn't rise to her level of vitriol. But if someone is genuinely threatening your life, you should defend yourself. Obviously, people are going to say, okay, well, Marx said that people should arm themselves as well.
Yep.
So that sounds about right.
Yeah, but the saying self-defense is a communist attribute is not really
well,
fair.
From the perspective of a communist, actually is. So they frame all of their revolutionary violence as justified because they're being aggressed upon by
but
the bourgeois superstructure.
But the concept of self-defense isn't exclusively communist. As in, everyone believes in the right to self-defense.
I agree, but...
So I don't see why we need to hand that over.
I'm being excessively charitable to their...
Yeah, that's way too charitable. I mean, you can just as easily argue that Locke was like, look, if someone tries to rob you, shoot them.
Based.
Yeah, no, he absolutely, he absolutely was.
Completely correct.
He had quite a good argument as well. It's like, look, if they've abandoned one set of laws, how do you know they haven't abandoned all the rest?
Yeah, you don't know to what extent they're going to escalate to threaten your life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you feel free to kill them.
Yeah.
It's like, actually, I agree with that.
Yeah. And considering Locke was a Christian, you can kind of see where the American principle of the Second Amendment comes from. But
it's a very English view.
Well, yeah, each person is sovereign in his own castle.
Yeah, exactly. Break into my house, I'll kill you.
Yeah. So I will just give the devil. And I mean the devil here, his due, when I read out Marx, where he says, where the workers are employed by the state, they must arm and organize themselves into special corps with elected leaders, or as part of the proletarian guard. Under no pretext should arms and ammunition be surrendered. Any attempt to disarm the workers must be frustrated by force, if necessary.
But the thing is, and this I hate this quote, because you see this quote going around all the time, and it's the left-wing argument for having firearms in America, right? And it's like, yeah, but it's not a point of principle.
No.
Right. It's an entirely pragmatic argument.
It's praxeological.
Exactly. It's a practical argument. It's like, look, it's just because where we are employed by the state, so it's contingent, right?
Mm.
It's not an Englishman should be armed, right? An Englishman should be able to defend himself in his house. That's not contingent. That's always, in every time, in every place. An Englishman should be an armed man, right? No, no, no. It's only when you're employed by the state, you need to arm because the state might not be in favor of the communist revolution that seeks to abolish it. It's like, yeah, no kidding. So it's totally contingent. And when that's over, okay, well, now give up your guns.
Yeah, you that's know? Not going to happen because you're preparing for revolution.
Exactly. But after the revolution, you're going to take away everyone's guns because now you don't want them to be able to resist the state.
Yeah, because the state speaks on behalf of the proletariat.
Quote, unquote,
and as Bakunin once criticized Marx for, he says, right, it's entirely redundant to set up a dictatorship of the proletariat when you're trying to transition into statelessness. Yeah. But it's also paradoxical that if the government truly represents the proletariat and the proletariat are all good, why would you do away with it in the first place? This is just a mask-off moment that you want power, isn't it, Marx? And that's why Bakunin and Marx weren't friends in the end.
Mm. But the point is, there's no point of principle in which the communist thinks that the proletariat should be armed. It's just, contingently, it's useful to be armed.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's purely utilitarian.
Yeah, and that's why, actually, Jesus says that those who go by aggression will fall to that. And so you have to mediate the circumstances in which you defend yourself as a point of principle. Because when they come from in the Garden of Gethsemane in Matthew 26, suddenly one of those who were accompanying Jesus reached for his sword, drew it, and struck a servant of the high priest, slicing off his ear. And then Jesus said to him, put back your sword into its place, for all who take the sword shall die by the sword.
Hmm.
And the point is, he already knew he was going to die and sacrifice himself anyway. So it was a futile endeavor to be aggressive.
Yeah.
And so that sort of indicts the Marxist project as, okay, well, if you're arming yourself purely to take vengeful aggression against someone, that's not in line with Christian teaching. Certainly consistent with the Marxist worldview, but they're not compatible. So
that's true, yeah.
So for those trying to conscript the two, doesn't quite work. Hmm. So I thought we'd just go on to what Marx thinks of religion, because that might elucidate whether or not that he ever intended compatibility with Christianity. And in his introduction to A Contribution to the Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right, he said the following: religious suffering is, at one and the same time, the expression of real suffering and a protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and the soul of soulless conditions. It is the opium of the people. The abolition of religion as the illusory happiness of the people is a demand for their real happiness. To call on them to give up their illusions about their condition is to call on them to give up a condition that requires illusions. The criticism of religion is, therefore, in embryo, the criticism of a veil of tears of which religion is the halo. Criticism has plucked the imaginary flowers on the chain, not in order that man shall continue to bear that chain without fantasy or consolation, but that so he shall throw off the chain and pluck the living flower. The criticism of religion disillusions man so that he will think, act, and fashion his reality like a man who has discarded his illusions and regained his senses, so that he will move around himself as his own true sun. Religion is the only illusory sun which revolves around man as long as he does not revolve around himself. It is therefore the task of history, once the other world of truth has vanished, to establish the truth of this world. It is the immediate task of philosophy, which is in the service of history, to unmask self-estrangement in its unholy forms, once the holy form of human self-estrangement has been unmasked. Thus, the criticism of heaven turns into the criticism of earth, the criticism of religion into the criticism of law, and the criticism of theology into the criticism of politics.
You've got to give Marx credit. He's a great writer.
He's very poetic, but the devil does have a silver tongue.
Yeah, of course. What I find interesting is that he really means Christianity.
Yes. He was born in a very Catholic part of Germany.
Obviously. And one thing that, if anyone has shown us anything, Nietzsche has shown, is that actually, no, religions have different constructs and different values. Like some religions are pro-oppression and aren't the opiate of the oppressed. They are not the balm that soothes. That is actually what Christianity is born out of. But some religions are totally in favor of conquest and subjugation, and they are not in any way going to be helping those people who have been subjugated.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.